on radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is Invest Talk, above average investing for the average investor. Invest Talk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. Here is KPP Financial Portfolio Manager, Luke Guerrero.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to Invest Talk. My name is Luke Guerrero, and it is Thursday, July 25th, 2024. And as always, the objective of this show is to help you become a better investor. Now, I brought a lot to the table today, some pretty interesting stories, I would say, and certainly we'll talk about the market as well. But most importantly, I want to hear from you. We've already heard from some of you. We have voicemails ready to play. We already have heard from some of you from our YouTube channel. But hopefully, over this next hour, I get to hear from you live at 888-99-CHART. Real easy number to remember. Really easy number to dial. Now, that being said, we'll talk about the market performance and run down those show topics in a little bit. But first, let's tackle our first caller question now.
Hello, my name's David from San Jose. Call me regarding Hershey Company, HSY. Had the stock for a while now. It looks like it's a little stagnant. Wondering if I should hold on to it or just get rid of it. Looking forward to your answer. Thank you.
So the question is about Hershey Company, that is ticker HSY. It is a almost $40 billion market cap company. It's got about $5 billion in debt. So in terms of debt, it's not too bad. Its cash flow has been improving over the past couple of years, which is solid. Its margins have compressed a little bit. Its net margin is still around 17%, which is pretty solid as well. Now, it has been stagnant year to date. It is only up 3%. On the 52-week, it is actually down 21%. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with, I think, multiple aspects. One part of it could be related to recent shifts towards, coming out of the pandemic, health trends that have really weighed on a company that whose revenue predominantly comes from sweets and comes from chocolates and comes from snacks. And that could be a part of it. There could be a secular shift there. Another aspect of it is that hedge funds have been making a lot of bets on cocoa prices. And so specifically with the chocolate aspect of this business, costs have been rising. And so it's been more difficult for them to operate as they normally would because cocoa has become a speculative product for a lot of hedge funds. I don't know what part of it lends toward one versus the other. It's important to note that their revenue growth has been pretty flat since 2022, from $10.4 billion to what's projected to be $11.4 billion. It's certainly a slowdown on what it usually was an average before that. You know, they grew from 2018 and $7.7 billion to almost $10.4 billion in 2022. That's pretty significant growth. It's really slowed over the past 2 years. So for me, potential trend towards being healthier, a lot of mess within this specific commodity market, and overall slowing growth. I think it's stagnating for a reason. I think it's doesn't have much room to run upward. I would probably just move on. Thanks for the call. Now we got around a lot of ground to cover, in the next 45 minutes or so. And here is some of what I have planned. My main focus point today concerns this story. Warren Buffett sells $1.48 billion in Bank of America. So why now? Warren Buffett, you all know who that is, recently sold approximately $1.48 billion worth of Bank of America shares, making his first sale since 2019. Buffett's decision may reflect cash management for succession planning or concerns over rising corporate taxes, or maybe even potential dissatisfaction with Bank of America's recent performance amidst significant unrealized losses. So what does that mean for investors, and can you take any hints from the moves of the Oracle of Omaha? We'll also talk a little bit about Q2 GDP data that came out today, stronger than expected, and what that means for markets and what that means for a potential rate cutting cycle come September. We'll also touch on maybe a propensity for investors to try and trade against election news. So how does that work out for them? Is that a good idea? Is there money to be made in trying to predict the outcome of the election? And should we have time at the end of the show, we'll talk about what has been driving this possible, I still say possible because we're really only 8 trading days into it at this point, possible tech rotation, and what does that mean for how you should be allocating your portfolios. We also have some voicemail questions ready to play, one on FLTR, the VanEck floating rate ETF, and one question about what to do with IRA money. We also have some questions that came in on the comment section of the Invest Talk YouTube channel. We always love getting to those as soon as we can. And of course, we welcome your finance and investment questions now or anytime throughout the next 50 minutes at 888-99-CHART. Now we're going into a short break, and on the other side, we'll talk about today's market activity. Please remember, you can call anytime and leave your questions on the Invest Talk voice bank. You can call during the show and talk to me live, or leave us a voicemail at 888-99-CHART.
On radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com.
My question today is about HME Equipment Services, Inc.
And for our podcast subscribers,
if you're willing to take the risk,
InvestTalk.
If you're okay with that risk,
with host and financial advisor Justin Klein,
and that volatility, go for it.
And co-host and portfolio manager Luke Guerrero.
This company has fallen like a rock. It's down 52%.
InvestTalk.
Ticker symbol THC.
Everybody wants a secure financial future.
Richard, you have a question about TOL?
But getting there takes strategy, discipline, and the right information.
Wonder what you think of the price of it.
Go to Chris in Maine looking at IEX.
Hey, Justin. I own it. Just seeing what you thought of it.
InvestTalk is made better by listener contributions. So don't forget to call 888-99-CHART. The more you learn about how the market works, the better your chances for success. So don't forget to call InvestTalk. 888-99-CHART.
Let's talk about the market today. And, you know, U.S. stocks were pretty mixed. They ended off their best levels from midday. Small caps continued to outperform. The Russell 2000 on track for a pretty healthy weekly gain. It was up 1.26% today, while large caps, the S&P 500 down 51 basis points. Tech NASDAQ down 93 basis points. Now, today's outperformers included energy, airlines, trucking, machinery, home builders did well today. Laggards included, semis, large cap pharma, multis, waste, apparel companies didn't fare too well today either. Gold was down 2.6% after a well-received treasury auction today. Copper finished up 0.5%, some welcome relief, breaking an eight-day streak of declines. Crude oil, WTI crude settled up about 1% at 90 basis points. And so a lot of that was driven by earnings. Earnings drove a lot of outsized moves with both fundamentals and expectations and sentiment moving forward, playing a pretty significant role. That small cap ripping lately, likely a continuation of the post-CPI rotation trade, and maybe looking forward to some interest rate cuts as well. We talked about yesterday a former Fed official saying there's no sense in waiting. I don't think they'll cut at next week's meeting. I think the market doesn't think they'll cut, but certainly they may provide some guidance about making some moves later in September. There was further evidence of this rotation with really growth and momentum lagging all throughout the market as well. Other areas of focus today, the lower rate backdrop certainly was a big focus, shift in seasonality, near-term reopening of corporate with the buyback window, and the yen carry trade unwinding, also pretty important to today's market moves. You know, they processed a lot of volume of earnings data today. Over 30% of the S&P 500 actually has now reported. Blended growth for Q2 is at about plus 10.3%, while this is pretty astounding. 78% have actually beat or are in line with the, have beat rather this quarter, which is in line with the previous four quarters on average. Initial jobless claims on the macro front dropped more than forecast week over week after last week's print was its highest since August of 2023. Continuing claims a bit better than expected, though down slightly off of last week's number. First read on Q2 GDP at 2.8%, an astounding 2.8%. Better than the 2% consensus, and certainly an improvement from the 1.4% Q1 pace. Though a lot of it looked to be driven by that business investment side from the The inventories, restocking of inventories was a big driver of that, as well as consumer spending. Personal consumption also beat pretty significantly. There was an implied number there on Q2 PCE of 2.9, a bit higher than what was expected, though down from the 3.7% level that came in Q1. But certainly tomorrow is the big day of the week where we'll be talking about June core PCE. It's been the highlight we've all been looking forward to. Will it be in line with what CPI was earlier in the month? And what will it tell us about potentially the Fed cutting rates in September? Now let's shift gears and go to Kimberly in Orinda, who has a question about Kava. Do you own it? Or are you looking
Kava,
to buy it?
Yes. Hi. I bought it, and I made this investment because I thought I might do well with it because Chipotle has done very well with their business model, and I thought this might, you know, be that kind of, you know, investment too. But recently it's just, you know, it's just been going downhill. And I just wanted your opinion to let me know if this was a good idea or should I just, you know, take my losses and, you know, forget about it.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a good question. Certainly, okay. I think you are correct in that Chipotle, a lot of, you know, fresher, if you will, fast food restaurants have certainly done very well. You know, since the beginning of the year, Kava has done pretty well, up 82%. I imagine you probably bought it near the highs, is my guess, given that you say you have some losses. You probably bought it around, you know, 90, 92, which is perfectly fine. But the reason why I probably wouldn't have bought it up there is that even right now, with the stock being down a little bit, the price to book is at 15, which is astoundingly high. Forward-looking price to earnings is at 187, price to sales at 11 times. So it seems to me like some of that, you know, exuberance and some of the joy from the run-up so far this year, it's snapping back down to reality. And why is that? Well, you know, a lot of people are paring back on what they're spending outside of the home. A lot of people aren't going to go to these restaurants, and these are some of the easiest ways that consumers can tampen down some of the spending that they need to, as their pocketbooks are a little pinched. Now, I will say there was some very interesting part of the GDP data talking about consumer spending power that was certainly unexpected. But all of that is irrelevant to me to the fact that this is priced really, really high, 83 times cash flow for a place that sells, you know, Mediterranean food. Just seems a little too rich for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Now let's dip back into the InvestTalk voice bank. Here comes a question from 888-99-CHART.
Luke, have a question for you. I accidentally timed the market. I converted a 401k, rolled it over to a IRA, and just by accident, it occurred last Friday. And so I have a chunk of money sitting in my new IRA. And I'm wondering, with the downturn in the market right now, what should I do? Should I roll it back into where I had it previously, which was the majority of the S&P 500? Or should I put it in a little bit at a time? Anyway, any help would be great. Love your show. Thanks. Have a good day.
Well, my condolences for inadvertently timing the market. I think we're all susceptible to that from time to time. Maybe you need to draw down on your savings for a big purchase and you happen to have to do it at the worst time. And so, you know, I would say a couple things here. One is, should the rotation away from you know, large cap tech, a lot of what's driven secular growth over the past 18 months, follow through? Probably the S&P 500 is going to be a little overweight some of the names that are going to underperform, at least in the near term. And that's not saying anything about the medium to long term, but certainly in the near term. Another thing I want to push back on is market downturn. It certainly could be a market downturn, but it could certainly also not be a market downturn. Every economics student who takes a class in college on economics has to learn about Malkiel and random walk theory and how daily prices in securities are essentially a random walk, right? Longer term trends, and I don't mean longer term being 8 days, are things that can extrapolate what is happening within the market. Is the universe significantly different today than it was 2 weeks ago? Maybe we've learned a little bit more about what CapEx has done with tech companies in terms of revenues that haven't really manifested themselves in AI, certainly. But I would pare back my reaction in terms of a couple days of trading down being a market downturn. Again, it could be. We could be heading for lower lows. We could be. We certainly could be. But don't, my main point is, don't draw conclusions yet based upon shorter term moves. Now, with that being said, historically speaking, empirically speaking, if you invest in the market at the all-time highs, you have positive expected return. And one way to protect yourself when you're trying to invest in the market is to do it a little bit at a time, dollar cost average in. So certainly, you know, I don't see anything that looks to be systematically stressing the market here, though typically you don't see the things that systematically stress the market. But if you, when you do get back into the market, yeah, there's nothing wrong with doing it piece by piece, dollar cost average in, potentially lower your cost basis, but not be left behind should the markets roar higher. Thanks for the call. Now moving into a break, still to come in the podcast, my primary focus point today about the Oracle of Omaha. We'll also tackle some YouTube comment questions, your voice bank calls, and hopefully some more live calls. So stay with me. Give us a call at 888-99-CHART.
Luke Guerrero is here and ready to tackle your questions.
I wanted to pick your brain about Apple. What did you think about their earnings call? Is this a good time to add to my position?
Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
You've got finance and investment questions, and Luke Guerrero is here taking your calls live. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Welcome back. And, you know, now I want to dig in to our main story today, which is about Warren Buffett selling $1.48 billion in Bank of America. So why did he did it? Why did he do it, rather? Now, any move that Warren Buffett, often, as I have referred to him twice, as the Oracle of Omaha, makes is immediate news. And recently, he decided to sell $1.48 billion worth of Bank of America stock. Now, this move, disclosed in a recent Berkshire Hathaway filing, marks the first major sale of the stock by Buffett since 2019. And so this is sparking widespread speculation about his motives and broader investment strategy. So let's dive into some specifics. Buffett reduced his stake in Bank of America by just 3.4%, yet this modest trim has pretty significant implications given B of A is Berkshire's second largest holding. It's also the first sale Warren Buffett was granted, the first sale since Buffett was granted permission to own more than 10% of the bank. He actually hit that cap in 2019, for regulatory reasons, decided to go over that 10% cap. And so why sell now? Well, there's several reasons. For one, Buffett may be preparing for a future without him at the helm of Berkshire Hathaway. Maybe he needs to free up some cash. He's 93 years old after all. Though, you know, you listen to him, he doesn't much sound like it. And despite that robust presence at his shareholder meetings year after year, he's been pretty candid about inevitability of succession. And so maybe reducing his position in Berkshire, or rather in Bank of America, is bolstering their cash reserves. So whoever the successor is has more flexibility to shape the next phase of his company. It also could be related to changes in corporate tax rates. Given the corporate tax cuts are set to expire, there's a potential for rates to revert, rates to potentially increase. So this could be a tax trade. Or maybe he just no longer wants to hold this name at this weight. For investment thesis reasons, maybe he's disappointed with the direction or maybe the risks associated with holding large bank stocks. The bank stock has certainly been performing robustly. It's near its all-time highs. And so, the market strength coupled with a complex regulatory environment, complex political environment, potential missteps across the board in asset management, they have some pretty unrealized losses in their MBS division, might have prompted Buffett to reassess the risk-reward ratio of maintaining a large position. You know, he didn't sell it all. He sold some of it. Now, why the sale is relatively small adjustment to Berkshire's extensive portfolio, it's a significant strategic move. It could signal a lot of things. Primarily, a cautious outlook about financials. But as always, no matter what the reason is, he's Warren Buffett. His moves are closely watched. It's a barometer for broader market trends, and it's a window into the strategic thinking of one of the world's most revered investors. Let's head on back to the InvestTalk voice bank and answer a question now.
I'm wondering if there are any pitfalls to owning a floating rate fund, such as FLTR, as a bond proxy bond substitute in my portfolio. dangers, pitfalls, things to be aware of that one might not see initially. Thanks very much. I enjoy the show. Good education. Have a great day. Bye.
So FLTR is the VanEck floating rate ETF. It tracks an index of U.S. investment grade debt and focuses on floating rate notes. You know, you're going to have some risks associated with doing this. This is a relatively cheap fund. It's a big fund. It's $2 billion. Its expense ratio is 14 basis points. Now, that's probably what you would expect. I imagine they do some sort of sampling method based on weighted average market cap. Yeah, it looks like the weighted average market value of a company can be no more than 2% of the fund. They have about 278 holdings. So they're trying to mitigate one of the risks of holding bonds, which is credit risk. And so floating rate, fixed rate, essentially, if you're not investing in U.S. government debt, you bear that credit risk there, right? Regardless of what type of bond it is. But with floating rate bonds, you're going to face some uncertainty, certainly, regarding interest rates. And so because floating rate bonds aren't fixed rate bonds, it's not like a fixed rate bond where they're issued, the bond covenant has a coupon rate, and then that coupon rate is what you're paid no matter what happens with the interest rates. And so bond values certainly adjust, right, with given the duration risk, given the convexity with how interest rates change. But with floating rate bonds, the interest rate itself is going to fluctuate with the market rate. So that's certainly a risk of floating rate versus fixed rate bonds. Now, there is market volatility and liquidity issues. They could certainly be less liquid, but you're really not exposed to that here, given that you're investing in an ETF. So I would say that generally speaking, with floating rate bonds, you're going to be exposed to a similar risk profile with any type of bond, but you also have to worry about that additional aspect of them, which is that the rate floats with the market rate. It's not fixed. Some things can change. And so certainly the price of these bonds can be pushed around in a more volatile way. Now, the next Invest Talk, we'll be talking about high-yield savings accounts and certificates of deposit, which offer different advantages for savers with varying interest rates, accessibility, and terms. We'll talk about what is best for your money. That's tomorrow, but for now, I'm Luke Guerrero, and I'm ready to take your calls at 888-99-CHART.
Got a question for Justin or Luke?
I've heard you say multiple times that you prefer shorter duration treasury bonds.
You're the best person to ask it.
Can you explain to me why it is more advisable?
The symbol is UNIT. Wondering what you thought about this REIT, if it would be a good time to get in.
InvestTalk is ready 24/7.
So I was thinking, is it a good idea to sell your losses in a Roth IRA and just use whatever you have left to reinvest into better stocks?
Just wanted to ask you about one stock that I'm looking at, Entergy ETR. If you could run that down for me.
Don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
AI might be the most important innovation ever. It's storming every industry with literally billions being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs the right data and a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? Time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, and application development with AI embedded across it all. And Oracle Sovereign Cloud helps you address your requirements for location, access, and data residency. OCI provides blazing fast speeds for AI's demanding workloads. And in the cloud, when you pay by the minute, speed matters. And of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. If you want OCI to help you do more and spend less, like Uber, the Premier League, and Oracle Red Bull Racing, take a free test drive at oracle.com/bandwidth. That's oracle.com/bandwidth. oracle.com/bandwidth.
This is Invest Talk now with 59 million downloads. Tell your friends they can listen live, download the free podcast, or watch Invest Talk on our YouTube channel. And they can leave their finance and investment questions anytime on 888-99-CHART.
So you all know I love answering your questions, and sometimes we pull voicemails. But sometimes we like to head over to our InvestTalk YouTube channel It's Invest Talk with two T's, and see what's going on in the comment section. So let's pull one from the comment section now. This one about AOS. It says, love the show. What are your thoughts on AOS? Well, AOS is AO Smith Corp. And what it does is it manufactures residential and commercial gas and electric water heaters. We love boring businesses over here, and this is certainly one of the businesses that we like. It has pretty significant growth for this class, right? 4% over the past 5 years is pretty solid for this type of company. Its cash flow has been improving over the past 5 years. Its profit margins look pretty solid, growing from 6.3% 2 years ago, projected to be 15% net margin this year. They have very little debt, only $167 million on an $11.84 billion company. They've been buying back shares for the past 4 years, pretty consistently, down from 170 million shares to about 147 now. And they pay a 1.58% dividend yield. They've been floating between 1.5 and 1.8 pretty steadily over the past 5 years. And their payout ratio is only 33%, so they can certainly afford that dividend. Now, I say from time to time, it's not just about being a good business. It's about being a good business at a fair price. And this is currently trading at 6x price to book, 20x cash flow, 3x its sales, which is near the upper end of its range over the past 5 years. And because of that, it has a consensus rating of hold amongst the 15 brokers that I see here that cover it. And I tend to agree with them here. I think it's a good business. I think the growth certainly doesn't justify its cash flow multiple right now. So certainly if I were going to invest in it, given that 22% of its revenue is coming from China, that's probably why growth has slowed so much. And until that being a pretty significant portion of its revenue, until that demand picks up again, I certainly could see this thing ranging for quite some time. So I would keep it on my watch list. It's a good business, certainly has done well over the years. But it's pretty stagnant right now, and for a good reason. Speaking of what's not stagnant, the U.S. economy surprised to the upside once again. Second quarter GDP posted at 2.8% annual growth rate, significantly surpassing last quarter Q1's 1.4% growth, and outpacing the 2.1% forecast by economists. So what drove this growth? Well, it was primarily driven by an uptick in consumer spending unexpectedly and increased business investment in equipment and inventories, which reflect really a rebound in economic activity and perhaps even some additional confidence that people were not expecting. So let's dig into the key takeaways here. Well, the first is about consumer spending and business investment. Consumer expenditures increased at 2.3%, a notable rise from the previous quarter's 1.5%. The increase suggests a resurgence in confidence and spending power, particularly on goods, even as service spending kind of moderated a little bit. Concurrently, businesses ramped up their investments, particularly in equipment, 11.6% growth in that area. What that does is really indicate that businesses are anticipating stability, maybe even growth on the economic front. And so they're spending money, they're upgrading, they're expanding. So what does this do for Federal Reserve policy? Well, despite the stronger than expected GDP growth, I think the Fed's immediate policy stance is probably going to remain the same. Possibility of rate cut in September remains contingent upon continued easing of inflation and other economic indicators aligning with it being okay to reduce a tightening stance. While the overall economic picture remains positive, challenges are still certainly there, particularly in the housing sector. Higher prices and mortgage rates have dampened down the spring home buying season, and that's certainly evident in this report. The second quarter GDP report actually highlighted not only the resilience, I would say, of the U.S. economy, but its adaptability. It's been a very, very complex situation here. It seems as though we are close to doing what nobody thought we could do, which is stick a soft landing. And this surprise to the upside is certainly more evidence of that. And it'll be interesting to see not just moving forward how that changes market expectations, but how that might change some of the comments coming out of the Fed next week. All right, let's get back to questions. This one about the S&P 500.
Hello, I had a question about the S&P 500. So I saw that it has been going down these past 2 days, and I was thinking about buying some probably around when it goes under 535, previously, when it was around 535, a lot of other sources were stating that the stock market was overvalued. And I think that if it falls below 535, that would be a good time to get in. Just wanted to know your thoughts. Please tell me what you think. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, I think this goes back to what I said earlier, and you certainly sound like a young guy, and that means that your time horizon is very long. And historically speaking, you have positive returns investing at the top. One way to mitigate prices moving down is to stagger your investment and dollar cost average into your positions. So nobody knows what the market's going to do tomorrow. Nobody knows what the market's going to do next week. Our next story talks about why it's so hard to predict what the market is going to do, which is why time in the market is always better than timing the market. So if your target entry is 5,300, sure, that seems fine to me. Generally speaking, if you pull out on a chart, it's up and to the right in the long term. So certainly investing in the market, though there may be more opportune times, it is easy to know that after the fact, but impossible to know it before. Thanks for the call. This is Invest Talk, now with over 59 million downloads. Let's keep going and make it two in a row.
Hey, Luke. I'm calling about Twilio, T-W-L-O. I wanted to get your thoughts. It's a stock around 56, 57 right now. It's been beaten down for quite some time. And now with this past few days with the tech pullback from Tesla and Google earnings, thinking it might be a good time to possibly pick some up. Love what you guys do and looking forward to hearing your thoughts. Thank you.
So let's take a look at Twilio. You know, this is one of those names that was a big darling of the tech growth space. And the reason why is because even with very little growth over the past couple years, 2 years, they exploded from 2018 to 2021. Over the past 5 years, your annualized growth rate is 44%, but certainly that's not the case over the past year. So we're supposed to make $4.3 billion this year. They made $4.1 billion last year. So growth has stalled. And with that stalling of growth, the market has certainly priced that accordingly. It's down 24% year to date. They actually didn't make any money. They're projected to make money this year. They have not made money in the past. Their margins are projected to be 12.4% net margin, which is certainly solid coming from a company that has yet to make any money at all whatsoever. But I think this goes back to the overall trends in the market. And so if you see a rotation out of growth tech, the last thing you should be chasing is growth tech, specifically companies that have not made money before and whose growth themselves are slowing. So I think there are better places for you to put your money. I do appreciate that you're trying to pick up some budget deals. People that know me know that I love deals, but I think this is not one of them. Thanks for the call. Now, the world of finance, trading floors are the epicenter of news consumption. Every global event is scrutinized for its impact on the markets, and they do a pretty good job. And so with elections scheduled across the globe that impact most of the world's population and investors, people are trying to figure out how can the smallest of stories impact markets. So how do elections impact markets? Well, the obvious answer is policies can change. There's a change in government policies. Government actions, such as fiscal policy, monetary policy, can dramatically shift sovereign bond yields, affect corporate profits, alter exchange rates, change regulation. The introduction of new subsidies or tariffs can play crucial roles in determining which industries will thrive and which ones won't. And so for investors, elections are kind of a double-edged sword. They offer a flood of data, a flood of new data, and potential market-moving events, such as unexpected political alliances, candidates dropping out. Who could have possibly done that? New candidates entering, new potential policies. And that can be enticing for people who think that they can make predictions and potentially quick gains. But this introduces a lot of risk to portfolios. The rapid pace at which information is processed on trading floors means that by the time a casual investor reacts to political events, the most profitable opportunities have likely already been seized by faster, more sophisticated, more ingrained market participants. Even if an investor manages to time their trades well, external factors such as beat in GDP or global events can quickly negate any gains from politically motivated trades. For example, even if an investor correctly predicts the outcome of an election, its immediate market impact, new data can be released the next day, which make those policy changes that somebody wanted to implement impossible to implement, which can lead to pretty significant losses. And that's because the complexity and interconnected nature of global markets mean that straightforward predictions can often lead to unexpected outcomes. While the temptation to leverage political events for trading gains, or really gambling gains, is strong, the reality is that such strategies involve very high risks, require an agility that most casual investors don't have, and really round-the-clock management of all the events that are happening all around the world. And so for most, especially those who aren't professionally trading and don't have the backing of professional trading firms, it's best to stay away from the fray here, not try and risk on short-term trades, and keep your mind focused on longer-term fundamentals and away from market speculation. Let's dip back into our log of questions from the InvestTalk YouTube channel. This one on UPS, it says, how do you reevaluate a company like UPS after horrendous earnings of almost 50% down on the bottom line? I'm just confused how a normal investor like myself can predict these things. So we talked about UPS the other day. We talked about some of the reasons why in the short term you can probably expect some volatility. And if you can stomach that volatility, why in the long run, UPS will probably do well coming out of this year and into years to come as freight picks up, as demand picks up. And so we won't rehash that. We talked about that a couple days ago. But instead, I want to get to the second question, which is, how can a normal investor like myself predict these things? You can't. Even professional investors cannot predict these things. Every time a company releases earnings, generally there's some sort of surprise, be it positive surprises, negative surprises. Trying to predict earnings is regularly and correctly and consistently is close to impossible. What's even more impossible is then trying to perfectly predict how a market that is built on trillions in trade volume is going to react to that impossible to predict earnings announcement. So don't get too stuck in trying to predict these earnings related moves. Okay? Keep focused on the long-term goals, a long-term lens, and realize that in the short term, all of this is just noise. Scroll out. Let's grab another caller question before we head to the break, because we got plenty of time.
Hi, Luke and Justin. This is Jake from Northern California. I have a two-part question for you today. The first is regarding COPX. I currently own it. I'm looking to see if the good buying opportunity to add. I currently hold it in my 403 and 457, so this would be a long-term hold. But after this recent pullback, I was just seeing what you guys thought of adding here. My current allocation is about 5% total. The other part of my question is I also hold GDX, and that's about 7% of my portfolio, bringing my total precious metal exposure to about 12 or 13%. So I was just wondering what you think of that volume in a retirement account, or if that's just too much precious metal exposure. Appreciate everything you guys do and look forward to your answer on the podcast.
Yeah, so COPX is a copper ETF. Certainly, copper has had a bad couple of days, really bad. 8 of the past 9 days were pretty bad. And you know, a lot of that is due to industrial demand and slowing global factors. But certainly, if you think that there is going to be a green transition. I'm not talking about EVs, stuff like that. But the reality is there is going to be a shift towards renewable energy. And copper is an important part of that. And so it's very difficult to get copper mines on on opened up, and times like this can be, if you think that demand will pick up, which it certainly will at some point, a good opportunity to invest in it. Now, the second part of that question about your precious metals exposure, generally speaking, I think having an exposure to precious metals is certainly a good thing in a retirement account. I think the traditional 60-40 mix that people recommend with equities and fixed income is not good for all situations, in that sometimes bonds and equities become correlated. And so having 10% exposure, 15% exposure to precious metals, I think is perfectly fine. If you think that US dollar debasement is a thing, then certainly having exposure to gold is going to be good. Certainly, the vice presidential nominee for the Republican Party has been mentioning about weakening the dollar. And so having gold in that situation could be good as well. But either way, I think having exposure to precious metals along with your equity and fixed income exposure in your retirement account, certainly a good idea. That was Invest Talk. I'm Luke Guerrero. Now we have one goal here. That's to help you achieve your financial freedom. Our work continues after this break, our final break. So get your questions in now at 888-99-CHART.
Every investor is working to build a secure financial future. The more you learn about how the market works, the better your chances for success. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Justin, Luke, hope all is well. Chuck from Clayton. Hey, got a question about UFP Industries, Union Frank Paul Ida. Bought it about a year and a half ago, 3%, kept moving up in my portfolio. I kept trimming it to 3%. Now I'm wondering if it's kind of run up its pace and overpriced at this point. What are your thoughts on it? I like it, but I'm wondering if it's about time to start cutting it out of my portfolio. Thanks for all you do. Have a great day.
So UFPI is an industrials company. It is a supplier of manufactured wood and non-wood composites, other materials, retail, packaging, construction markets. And, it's had a pretty good year on the rolling one year period time frame. 52 weeks, it's up 25.57%. The average 5-year return is 42%. It's outperformed the S&P 500 on an average 26%. It's industry by 11%. It's because its growth has been pretty stable, pretty consistent, and pretty good. The exception of, this year, which to be expected with what's going on in building and construction, the revenue's fallen a little bit. But in spite of that, from 2018 to 2022, they grew from $4.4 billion in revenue to $9.6 billion in revenue. Their margins steadily improving from 3.2% to projected to be 6.8% this year in terms of their net margin. They don't have much debt. It's $384 million in debt on a $7.3 billion market cap company. And they pay a 1.11% dividend yield. And so when I see cash flow improving, when I see profitability, profit margins are improving, when I see earnings being stable, certainly not as robust as they have been, but that's a byproduct of the demand. And I see a company that has performed consistently well. Now they're set to report earnings at the end of the month on July 30th, the consensus is 2.03, sales consensus $1.872 billion for the quarter. So it'll be interesting to see how this company does relative to those estimates. But the original question was, is it too expensive? Just because things appreciate in price doesn't make them expensive inherently. It's had growth. It's price to cash flow 7 times. It's perfectly fine. It's price to book 2.4 times. Again, perfectly fine. It's at its averages. It's forward-looking price to earnings 14 times. This is all perfectly fine. I think what you're doing within your portfolio is great. You have a name that has been consistently good for you. It's a well-run business. There are no red flags here. It doesn't look like it's overly expensive in any way. But rather than let those gains run and run and run, you are strategically trimming back to what your original target weight is. And so with all of what I'm seeing, I don't see any reason why you should totally divest from this name. And I don't see any reason why, as demand starts to pick up within the construction market, as demand starts to pick up both Within the U.S., although it is primarily U.S. exposure, about 96% of it is U.S. exposure. Only 4% of it is foreign exposure. As demand starts to pick up, what you could see is a return to the growth that they have had historically, which is that 10% annualized growth rate. And certainly with their margins improving, that'd be great for the business. I like it. Thumbs up. Now, I'm Luke Guerrero, and this completes another Invest Talk program. We thank you for listening, and we encourage you to tell your friends and family members about our free podcast downloads. You can give it to iTunes, you can give it to Google Play, you can give it to Spotify. But if you give it to iTunes, please be sure to rate and review it. Also, don't forget to come check out our Invest Talk YouTube channel or our Invest Talk Instagram, both of which are Invest Talk with two T's. We got one more day left in the week. PCE's tomorrow. I can't wait to talk about it with you all. Independent thinking, shared success. This is Invest Talk. Good night.
Invest Talk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.